On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So here's the key question. To what extent has the pandemic disrupted a defendant's right to a speedy trial in Wisconsin? We're examining what these times have brought to representing some of the most disadvantaged people in our court system. What questions do you have for Wisconsin State Public Defender? What do you want to know about how the Public Defender's Office handles caseloads, especially now? 800-642-1234. Kelly Thompson is Wisconsin State Public Defender. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, last year, the pandemic delayed some criminal cases from being resolved. What is the status of our state's court system now?
Well, Kate, as you can imagine, as the pandemic has continued and the significant impact it's had on the entire state in every area, it's had that much of an impact. System. As you and I talked about before, and as we've heard, constitutional rights, due process, they don't take a break for a pandemic. They don't say, hey, something's going on. We can't fulfill our obligations. Those obligations are always there. And our attorneys and our staff are, that's their job. That is what they have to focus most on. So a pandemic hits, we have to consider how to do our jobs, how to be as creative as possible, but how to be able to continue to represent exactly what you said, those most disadvantaged, those most marginalized in our system, and sometimes some of the most difficult cases. So the pandemic hits, we continue to try and do our job. We use things that everybody's using. Technology becomes a bigger part of our lives. And as you can imagine, the public defender's budget, we were not prepared for that, but we did everything that we could to get ready so that we could continue to visit with clients, to see families, and to continue those court hearings that need to continue. Make sure that our clients have their day in court, they have their rights being respected, that things can move forward, but in unusual ways. And because our staff from the get-go were considered essential workers and are considered essential workers, their jobs never stop. So while we can employ technology, we still have to be able to see our clients in person. We have to be able to work through all of the information, and it's called discovery, all of the evidence in a case. And most importantly, we have to be there to communicate with them. That communication part is so incredibly critical and important in the work that we do.
So what is the status of the backlog? What do the numbers look like?
I can't give you numbers. I can tell you significant. So early on, certainly the case filings were down. You know, everyone's trying to figure out how to get people out of custody if possible. People weren't able to charge cases as much. And quite frankly, I think, you know, people were homebound more. So cases weren't quite as prevalent. You know, law enforcement was trying to do everything they can to keep people safe. But certainly case filings were down, but we've seen the impact of that. We have a backlog of thousands of cases. I mean, thousands. And we have cases now, we had that kind of short term where cases were down, the filings were down. But now in some counties, they're still down. In some counties, we tend to target, per year. And at this time last year, we have case filings that are actually up more than they were a year ago. So that backlog, and that backlog is significant because what you have is we have our cases continuing, and then we know we have this backlog sitting there, and the courts as a whole, and luckily in our criminal justice system in Wisconsin, and it's definitely at the county level, people tend to work pretty well together. So you have the judges and the public defenders and the DAs and clerks all trying to figure out, law enforcement, how we're going to start getting these cases through. But it's going to take years. Okay? Mm. It'll take years to get through the backlog of cases that people have.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kelly Thompson, Wisconsin State Public Defender. We're discussing the status of public defenders, the caseload, and the work of people who are assigned to defend people who cannot afford a lawyer, legal representation in our criminal justice system. What do you want to know about how the Public Defender's Office is handling these times? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. Even prior to the pandemic, the mentally ill languished in jail. I have a mentally ill brother. course, he can't afford a public defender. He can't afford a defender and he'd have to wait to be assigned one. He would languish sometimes. He was in jail 6 months or more just waiting for a trial. And so I'm wondering, they're one of the most vulnerable. What is going to be happening going forward? So those people are potentially sitting in jail for years. I mean, he didn't see the light of day for 6 months or more at point prior to the pandemic.
Lisa, you hit it on the head. One of our most significant issues in the criminal justice system is the number of mentally ill people or people with mental health issues, some diagnosed, some undiagnosed, that get involved in our criminal justice system, sometimes just because of their mental health issues that go untreated. And so we see that impact every single day. The number of, you know, the percentages are hard to actually quantify. You know, sometimes we hear up to 70 or 80% of the individuals in our prison system have mental health issues. Again, some diagnosed and some undiagnosed. And that impact really does prey upon individuals. And we do. I would love to say, you know, your case is an anomaly. That is not the case. We have people with pretty significant mental health issues that are sitting in our jails and in our prisons for months and for years. If you have just, we have people right today that are having, now jury trials are going on around the state, not in all counties, but in a lot of the counties. But we've had people that have been sitting over a year, over 2 years, just waiting to have their trial. These people are sitting incarcerated and they are presumed innocent. Now take one of those individuals who has mental health issues and sometimes significant mental health issues. And as Lisa, I think, has identified, sometimes those mental health issues are the reason that they're there. And the jails are not hospitals. They're not mental health hospitals. You know, our law enforcement officers and workers, oftentimes, you know, they almost have to double as, you know, mental health. Some of them have some crisis support training, but they're not trained for that. And our jails are not equipped for those. And yet our prison system is, quite frankly, our largest mental health hospital in the state. It's also the most expensive and less effective way to treat our individuals with mental health issues. And yet that's what's happening. So now you have a pandemic, you have all the other cases going on, and then you have the families of these individuals who are sitting in custody just trying to figure out how to get them out. And because of these backlogs and because of the delays that, again, everyone's trying to work on. This isn't a system that's like, oh, well, we're not worried about that. That's not the case. I mean, the Chief Justice, the Supreme Court came out really pretty early on with guidance to what counties can do. And then they've had these task force working to make sure that people have in place so that the courts can get back running, so that people can get back into court safely, obviously safely, with the, you know, social distancing and all that. But so many of our individuals are sitting in the jails. And I'll take it one step further. You have individuals who are sitting in custody. Now we have people that have cases that they are likely looking at a jail term. And how do we look at, as public defenders, look at those individuals and say, you know, I know you, you know, we need to get your cases finished, but you have you know, you may likely go sit in a jail cell for 3 or 4 months. And by the way, we have a pandemic going on. We have the coronavirus. I mean, people are left with such terrible choices and such difficult choices. And so those cases are languishing. And people, some of those people are out of custody with that burden hanging over those, knowing that you know, they have this this case that needs to be resolved. And then we have the people that are sitting in custody. We have so many people sitting in custody. So what Lisa said is, it's constantly working. It's constantly trying to figure out to bring attention to those cases. It's, you know, public defenders are there every single day. Their Kelly, workload has not gone away. Yes.
Kelly, I want to just jump in here on the issue of mental health of your clients. Do you see clients who suffer from serious mental health illness, but the illness doesn't rise to the level of a legal defense like insanity?
Oh, yes. That's most of the cases. Most of our cases don't, you know, we have some that'll rise to the level of a defense of insanity. We have certainly mitigating factors where we can bring before a judge, you know, when resolving a case, saying this individual, you know, we have these health records, we have family members like Lisa that will come in and explain what's going on. And those are mitigating factors. But for actually the, you know, not guilty by mental disease or defect, that defense is very rarely used. Very, very. So these individuals have these diagnoses that certainly play a part or a role in the crimes that have been committed, or the reason, sometimes not a crime, but the reason they're in the jails, but they're not, they don't rise to that level.
We're talking with Wisconsin's state public defender, Kelly Thompson, about how justice is working for the most disadvantaged people in the court system. Do you know someone in jail currently awaiting a trial? How are they doing? What are you most concerned about during this time? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kelly Thompson here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new study from Rutgers University says public defenders in our country are under enormous psychological stress from budget cuts, from huge caseloads, and the pressures placed on the justice system by COVID. The study involved dozens of public defenders across the country to investigate occupational stress. It's called the stress of injustice. Attorneys, share what your job is like, what punitive laws and practices target and punish people who are the most disadvantaged in our system. What reforms do you seek? Join in 800-642-1234. Kelly Thompson is Wisconsin State Public Defender, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Davio is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Davio.
Hi. Ms. Thompson, I just had a question for you. I recently got into some trouble with the law myself when I got out of high school, and it got me looking a lot into prison conditions and things like that. And my question for you is, we live in a great country, but we have a lot of problems. And to me, the conditions for inmates and guards alike in a lot of our prisons and jails seems to be kind of alarming. I was just wondering what the front for prison reform in Wisconsin looks like.
Well, Daddy, that's a great question. I agree. You know, unfortunately, in our jails and our prisons, you have what very well-intentioned people that are trying to do a lot with very limited resources. And oftentimes when we see budget cuts, those resources happen, you know, in programming and what have you in the prisons. There's no doubt about that. Jails are oftentimes, you know, old and haven't been refurbished in a long time. And so our individuals are sitting in cages, and oftentimes crowded, and the conditions certainly are, I think that's one of the most difficult stressors for families, not obviously for the individuals there, but for their families. And then you take a pandemic on top of that. So now you have people that are crowded, even with the care of the individuals that are working there, there's nothing you can do. And oftentimes when you're, you know, such limited of areas. So, you know, prison reform is an area that's a national topic that's really, I think, really heating up. First of all, are the right people? We have to start with, do we have the right people sitting in jails and prisons? I would argue no. So we have to start looking at that on the front end. There's no doubt that we have to really refocus our attention. Do we have people that are sitting there, again, as what Lisa talked about, people with mental health issues? Do we have people with alcohol and drug addictions that can be cured in other ways in the community? Once we take someone out, we have to really focus on the fact, and this would be more at the jail level, when we take someone out of their community, especially people who are already unstable in some respect, you know, economically or what have you, you take them out of the community for 24 to 48 hours, we've destabilized their lives. There's no doubt about that. Their lives were already, you know, less than stable. We've destabilized their lives. Once we destabilize one of these individuals' lives, we've destabilized their families and we've destabilized our community. So we're not making our community safer. We have to understand that. So we have to really figure out that we're the right people, you know, for the right crimes are sitting in our jails and prisons. We tend to put people in jail and in prison who are in jail pre-trial that could still be out in the communities. And that's been a big focus. And I will tell you at the county level, counties are really taking this seriously. We've had a lot of that pre-trial reform where people are looking for alternatives to get people out of custody while they're waiting for their cases to go through. Because when my clients are in custody, they're going to make decisions that aren't always in their best interest. They need to, if I'm sitting in custody waiting for my case to be heard, and now it's being delayed and delayed, and I have three children sitting at home like I do, I'm going to make a decision that's best for short term for my family to get me out, not necessarily going to trial on that case. And that's, you know, people understand that, but we really have to focus on that. And then long-term for prison reform, we have to really continue to find the programming that gets people back out on their feet. When people are released from a prison system, we should hope to never, ever see them again. And we should hope to never see them again in a good way, that we've given them the tools and the resources to be successful. And that has to be educationally. Education is, we know this is such a key part, but we really have to focus on really revamping our prisons and looking at these as educational places and at treatment facilities. We already know, I've already talked about the mental health, but already the addiction issues that lead to people being in prisons, that people have alcohol and drug addictions. We have to continue to revisit these prisons and make sure that we're providing everyone who wants an opportunity gets that opportunity. We have what, between in a normal time, and I'm quoting air quotes, normal time, 8,000 to 9,000 individuals coming out every single year. And only what, a tiny portion of them have had the programming that really is necessary. And it's because of, we haven't put that funding there. So this is a constant conversation, and it's a constant conversation that community members like yourself, Davio, have to be having with your lawmakers, because if they understand that this is a priority for the communities, this makes our communities safer. These individuals go back and they become part of, you know, a productive community. We will see some of the benefits that nationally other states are seeing as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kelly Thompson, Wisconsin State Public Defender. We're discussing legal defense amid the pandemic for people who can't afford a lawyer. Taking your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Kelly, I want to look at the shortage of public defenders. Prior to the pandemic, there was a shortage in some areas, especially like Racine County. What is retention like for state public defenders currently?
Oh, such a good question, Kate. And it's really been difficult. And it's been so difficult during a pandemic. So, you know, let's do real quickly. So we had staffing public defenders where retention has been difficult. And that's, you know, was a good thing because the economy was good. It was terrible for me, but the economy was good. And our public defenders were being asked to do other positions for more money. And I didn't have the capability to pay them, which really, really impacts our criminal justice system, because when we lose individuals, those cases get delayed. I have to try and find other people to take on those cases. And we're not talking about a few cases. We're talking each public defender handles hundreds of cases. So that was, and then we had the private bar. Luckily, the rate was raised. And so all of a sudden, we had private bar attorneys that were willing to take some of those cases, which was wonderful. But then we have the pandemic hit. I have to tell my staff from day one, I understand you have your own health concerns, you have your own health issues, you have your families, but I'm asking you to put your own health aside and continue to represent individuals. And our staff stepped up absolutely from day one across the state. But that pandemic has hit hard, and we have a pay disparity now with prosecutors that we've never had. This happened in the last budget. So my public defenders are being paid less than their counterparts across the aisle, and they are doing more work than they've ever had to do before in the most difficult situations, in the most difficult circumstances. And we've lost throughout this pandemic. Our numbers are, I would say, alarming, the number of people that we've lost throughout the last, 8 to 9 months. And that has impacted the state, because that slows down the entire criminal justice system. It doesn't just impact me. It impacts, most importantly, the clients, most importantly, the community and their families. But it also impacts the entire criminal justice system, because I have to constantly be hiring to try and get individuals my job pitch is, you're not going to make a lot of money. You're going to make a big difference in individuals' lives, and you're going to work around the clock in some really difficult situations. And people step up, but that has been a big challenge. So, our public defenders are critical. They're essential. They have worked around the clock. But it is, I will say, we've been hit hard. This pandemic has hit internally in our offices. This pandemic has hit our staff really, really hard with the loss of some of our staff.
Kelly, as you look at the other side of this pandemic, in the last minute we have here, what aspects of COVID changes to court proceedings may become permanent after the pandemic?
The changes have to be, that's a great question. We've had task force looking at. So obviously technology, when you're in rural Wisconsin for things that are would consider being less important, like the status conferences, well, my clients don't have driver's licenses and they don't have vehicles to get around, using technology can be really, really helpful, but technology can't can't take the place of having that individual in a courtroom during serious and substantive hearings. They have to be there. It's so important for them to understand and be seen. I need them to be seen by the judge and by the prosecutor as real individuals. And technology, while it works really well for us and we can bring our clients in even during these really difficult periods of time, they don't have the capacity, the capability, and the financial resources for technology. So technology will be used. We can use technology in the prisons now a little bit more to have some of our client communications in our conversations. So that's been very helpful. And I know that, we have to sign off, but Kate, technology is a wonderful thing that just has to be used cautiously. And I think it will be by the criminal justice system.
Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Anytime, I'm always welcome or willing to come in and talk to you. And I really want to thank you and tell you how much we appreciate you taking time to talk about public defenders in our criminal justice system.
Kelly Thompson is Wisconsin State Public Defender. We have Representative Goyke, Evan Goyke, after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our state's mask mandate to limit the spread of COVID remains in place for now. Republicans are investigating whether there's a way to pass their compromised COVID relief bill without losing federal money. Eliminating Governor Evers' latest health emergency would jeopardize $49 million in federal food aid that is connected to having an emergency declaration. Here's Governor Evers at a press conference Friday.
It's unbelievable to me that we can have the entire health world opposing them striking down this order. And they ignore the science. They ignore the people that implement the science. The options are few.
Has the governor overstepped his power by requiring people to wear masks? Or were Republican lawmakers putting politics ahead of public health? 800-642-1234. Evan Goyke is a Democratic state representative from Milwaukee. Representative Goyke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Step back for us and explain how Wisconsin would have lost this food aid directed at more than 240,000 Wisconsin families had lawmakers ended the governor's health emergency declaration.
Yes. So an act of Congress gave an increase to those Wisconsinites that receive food share, food stamp benefits during COVID, but only two states that also had an emergency declaration for COVID. So it was a federal action and a state action. And we learned late Wednesday and then brought to life early Thursday morning the fact that the Senate resolution to end the emergency order and thus the mask mandate would have cost 240,000 Wisconsinites this additional food share benefits. And I just want to make sure listeners understand when we played in the clip, it wasn't just $49 million, period. It was $49 million a month for about 250,000 Wisconsinites. So really a massive reduction in federal funding for about 250,000 Wisconsinites.
What did you do when you got this memo?
Well, I called my friend Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel so that he could tell his friends and readers and listeners. We raised as much trouble as we possibly could. And some of the questions that we asked were not just limited to food share. These acts of Congress during COVID are very long. They're thousands of pages long. And we just, at this moment, don't know the extent of federal funding that we put in jeopardy by ending the emergency order. And I'll just note that this resolution, the legislative vehicle to do this, really has gone through no legislative processes. Normally in Madison, in the Capitol, we have hearings and people come to testify and there's arguments. None of that happened in this resolution. It went directly to the floor without any kind of hearing. You could hear an exasperated Tony Evers talk about the medical community. There are 53 organizations opposed to the resolution ending the emergency order and the mask mandate. There are zero groups that have registered in support.
Is there, you alluded to this, is there other federal funding that could be jeopardized by overturning the order?
At this moment, I just don't know. We have posed that question to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. I assume some of them worked long through the weekend, but as of airing right now, we don't know. And that was a concern. Well, it's still a concern, but Thursday, really in an unusual act where the majority party paused their action and the wheels kind of fell off the train for the day for them, we don't have firm answers to those questions. And quite honestly, that's why you have a transparent political process that brings in the voices of people directly affected and those organizations directly affected. And so that we can have a firm answer to that question before we vote on legislation.
Assembly Speaker Voss has said he still plans on overturning the mask mandate, possibly as soon as this week, but wanted to better understand the ramifications first. Where do things stand right now with a compromise relief bill?
Well, it looks like the Republicans in the legislature are trying some legislative gymnastics. They're trying to amend a bill that would give the governor a kind of truncated power to issue an emergency order for the purposes of getting federal funding. But look, these are the same individuals that a week ago didn't know that their legislation would cost us $50 million a month. And so They I don't think can be trusted with either really knowing the extent of their legislation or the prudent management of federal funds. They're trying to amend a bill that is laden with partisan poison pills that would strip the governor's powers for managing federal relief dollars. And it really is not they're calling it a compromise. There was a compromise COVID bill a few weeks ago, but Assembly Republicans added those partisan poison pills. It is no longer a compromise, and it's not a real solution to mitigating COVID and ensuring that we retain our federal funds. And just this last point, the way that we do that, the way that we mitigate COVID and make sure we get our fair share of federal funding is to do nothing. It is to not repeal the governor's emergency declaration and mask mandate. Those are in place. Those are working. It's one of the most effective tools we have. So we need to not end the mask mandate. That's the only way we ensure that we don't lose federal funding and that we respond in one of the best ways we can to this public health crisis.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Evan Goyke, who is a Democratic state representative from Milwaukee. We're discussing the mask mandate, whether lawmakers can come together to pass some sort of relief legislation. Taking your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Rich is joining us from Rhinelander this morning. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks. Late last week, I called my state senator, Felskowski from Tomahawk to speak, and also my assemblyman's office. And in a very robotic, almost read from the text script, I was told again and again that the Republicans are protecting the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin from Governor Tony Evers' excessive overreach. And I told them in my response in the call, I said, I find that ridiculous in our current circumstances.
So Rich is saying that the response he got from calling lawmakers is this is about overreach, Representative Goyke.
Yeah, that seems to be their argument. I find it pretty hollow. I think it's about politics and trying to appease a conservative base and levy a defeat against Governor Evers. I think Speaker Voss went so far as to hint that the governor was acting like a dictator. Those of us who know Tony Evers, he's not a dictator. You just listen to the clip you played earlier as we began the program. This is one of the most important tools to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. One of the important things about this emergency order and the state playing a role, government playing a role in requiring masks, is so that public sector, private sector actors don't have to be out there being the mask police. And it's a way that businesses can keep their employees and customers safe without spending so much time trying to enforce different rules. Imagine if in the grocery store, any grocery store could have their own rules, and who would be enforcing that? This is the role of government. It is a moment like this and an emergency like this that the government exists to issue these kind of orders. And so I just don't see it. I agree with Rich. I don't see it the same way that his elected officials do. And I want to applaud him for contacting his elected officials. Clearly, the public advocacy matters. It changed the outcome of the vote last week. And I just encourage the listeners to follow Rich's lead and dig in and contact their representatives. And if they give robotic red answers, challenge them on that.
Representative, how have you reached across the aisle? What conversations have you been having with Republican lawmakers about this mask order?
Well, I think that the last one of the last points I was just making about what happens if this is lifted in the private sector has been a concern that some of my Republican colleagues have voiced. But I will tell you that they voiced that concern very quietly, privately, sheepishly. They're wearing a mask in the state capitol. I'm wearing a mask. So they're kind of in whispered tones, careful not to be too public to take a position on this order because they're fearful that there would be political ramifications. And, you know, I see on social media, you know, the kind of rabid conservative base, arguing that they should challenge in primary elections to challenge Republicans that don't forcefully oppose this order. And so out of one side of them of their mouth, they privately, quietly want the order and understand that it helps a lot of their constituencies and the businesses they represent. But out of the other side of their corner of their mouth, they're professing standing up to Governor Evers and pledging to overturn the emergency order and mask mandate.
If you're just joining us, we have State Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee talking about the prospects for COVID relief legislation, the partisan gridlock over the mask mandate in the legislature. Do you see room for compromise between the governor and the legislature? What do you think Democratic lawmakers who are in the minority should do now to try to work with Republicans on the pandemic? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Democratic Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee. Last week, he asked the Legislative Fiscal Bureau for a fiscal impact analysis on what it would mean for Republicans to end the governor's public health emergency. And that fiscal memo response Wednesday said it would jeopardize $49 million a month in food aid to more than 242,000 households in Wisconsin's Food Share program. Have you relied on Food Share or other programs to feed your family and get by in difficult times? What do you want lawmakers to know? 800-642-1234. And Representative Goyke is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Anne now, joining us from Campbellsport. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Yesterday, I heard Senator Felskowski defend the Senate's attempt to end the mask mandate, saying because Governor Evers' mandate was illegal, we would have lost the funds anyway. I don't know what the Republican strategy would have been had that come to fruition, she didn't say, but I mean, that argument was so laughable, I laughed out loud. One other quick comment I want to make is I recently saw a picture of Senator Glenn Grossman at a Lamira Chamber of Commerce meeting, sitting at tables with elderly people, room full, not one person in that room had nothing. That's all. I'll take your comment off the air. Thank you.
Representative Goyke, go ahead there. Two comments there from Ann.
Sure. One, the emergency order is not illegal. We are receiving those benefits now. There is litigation on the legality of the governor's emergency order, but that has not yet been decided, and I don't have a firm date on when that is. But the senator that you quoted was wrong. And then the second comment about public officials not wearing masks, being in crowded rooms without masks. I've seen a number of my Republican legislative colleagues and their staffers in the state capitol walking around fairly brazen without wearing their mask as if it's a badge of honor. And the words and actions of leaders, including elected leaders, matter. It's one of the reasons why the mask mandate is important. It's the government modeling one of the best behaviors we can promote to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. So it's really unfortunate to hear the comment that Representative Glenn Grothman was kind of modeling poor behavior, especially in a room with, sounds like, particularly vulnerable individuals. And so keeping the order and validating it is an important message that elected leaders can send across the state.
So the state Senate and Governor Evers had appeared to me moving toward a compromise on a response to the pandemic, but Republicans in the assembly insisted on several measures. What are your thoughts on what Republicans are pushing for?
I have no idea. They have no idea. The Republicans in Madison have no plan. They have no agenda. The legislation you're referencing is Assembly Bill 1, which could be a bipartisan COVID relief bill that the Senate Republicans and Governor Evers negotiated. In that form, in the form it was negotiated, received bipartisan support. In the Assembly, legislative Democrats in the Assembly, we were ready to vote for it. And then at the final hour, Republicans added a number of provisions, one of which would give legislative Republicans kind of final say on any federal dollars that the state receives to combat COVID-19. And as we've been pointing out, that would be a very bad idea. I don't trust their management of things like vaccination distribution dollars or dollars to schools or, for this public health response. And they've shown that they can't be trusted by trying to rush through legislation without even knowing the long-term fiscal consequences of their actions. I was hopeful. So really behind the curtain, if you want to know what's happening, there's a power struggle between Assembly Republicans and Senate Republicans. And that power struggle is resulting in the inability to pass meaningful legislation in April of 2020. The two chambers and two parties came together and passed legislation when we really needed it. We did it with urgency and we did it together. The compromise bill that's mentioned does many of those things that we already agreed to do back in April. It just extends those things, which we need to reauthorize. That's where we should start. We should pass that bill. We could do it tomorrow. We could send it to the governor's desk, and relief could be coming on as soon as Wednesday. And then we can take back up our disagreements and arguments. But the battle between Republicans in the Senate and the Assembly is preventing bipartisan legislation from reaching the finish line.
We're talking with Evan Goyke, a Democratic state representative from Milwaukee. We're looking at the actions by the legislature to pass COVID relief legislation, what it looks like, and the impasse with the parties. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Melissa is joining us from Racine. Hi, Melissa.
Good morning. I am just calling with a few comments. I guess piggybacking on previous callers and in terms of the brazen attitudes that you have seen from your own fellow workers, I for the first time reached out to my representative last week. I've never done so before. And the response from one of the gentlemen I spoke with was, well, what would you have done if this was Governor Walker that would have issued such a mandate? And my response to that, one, taken back a little bit, was that, of course, I would agree to a mandate that protects the health of our citizens here in Wisconsin. Two, that same attitude that you're seeing carrying over on the Senate floor is actually carrying into our community. I was at an appointment this week for a medical appointment, and lo and behold, Senator Wangard was there. Him and I were the only ones in the room. And he came in without a mask, asked if he had to put one of those things on. And to someone who's been home since March due to compromised health, and I'm a special education teacher, having to virtual world, it was very upsetting, very alarming, especially as he's one of the reps I had reached out to. So I am concerned about how.
Melissa, you're breaking up. We got your story. Representative Goyke, Melissa, very concerned as a special education teacher and also seeing her lawmaker in public without a mask.
Yeah, I think that it emphasizes the modeling of good behavior that elected officials need to do. And you retell the exact opposite, somebody modeling bad behavior and almost making light of it. To the point about whether a Republican governor would, if they had an emergency order and a mask mandate, would we be, as a Democrat, would I be fighting it? And the answer is no. It's a public health order meant to save lives and mitigate the spread of a virus that I have every intention of not getting and my loved ones not getting. And, we're nearing 6,000 people dead in Wisconsin. There are Republican-controlled states that have mask mandates. There are Democratic-controlled states that have mask mandates because the science of wearing a mask is clear, not disputed. It is one of the most effective tools we have to mitigate the spread. And if the government does not have this type of order, behavior will begin to change, and that will lead to negative outcomes. And we've seen that in our state and in other states. When we relax our efforts, or when we repeal orders or litigate or sue, or these decisions have consequences. So I encourage people to continue to call, to ask those questions, continue to model that good behavior and set the example for everybody else.
We only have about 20 seconds left, but I just wanted to ask you this. Your city, Milwaukee, just came off of a horrendous year for homicides, 190, shattering the previous record. What are you doing legislatively, policy-wise, to try to curb the violence in Milwaukee?
It's a great question. And that violent year comes after 2 years of progress. And so our goal, my policy focus, is how do we fund what works? How do we make sure that we have the correct investment on the neighborhood level, block by block, things like the Office of Violence Prevention, efforts to work with police and citizens together. But we need a new strategy, and we need state level resources to help citizens of Milwaukee engage and see better outcomes. And I've seen it possible. I've seen it work in my community.
Representative Goyke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Evan Goyke is a Democratic state representative from Milwaukee. Just ahead, how to combat the so-called quarantine 15. We talk with a dietitian about how to trim those extra pounds. Are you trying to lose weight this year? What questions do you have about your diet and exercise? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a State Capitol Report, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.